E-commerce Podcast, the show that sheds light on hidden levers that can help you 10x your business. Join us as we talk to experts and find out the 1% improvements that you can apply right now to take you there.
Hey, everybody. I am here today with Adam Sidney. He's the CEO of Miles Apparel, a really fascinating direct consumer brand, and just thrilled to have him on the show. Adam, welcome.
Thanks, Lance. It's good to be here.
So, Adam, I know that you've got an interesting, varied background. We were chatting a little bit about your audio experience, but tell me a little bit about how you ended up as CEO of Miles.
Yeah, it's a long story, obviously. I think it starts with the fact that I'm the last of four kids and the son of a couple of doctors. Of my three siblings, two of them are also doctors, and then the third one is he writes hospital software. So pretty much like a homogenous family there in medicine. Being the last of four, I think I assumed I was going to go that direction as well. It's part of how I chose to go to Duke University because they have a great medical program. And I think something compelled me to go do something different, maybe being a black sheep of the family, or could have been that I had a really influential economics professor in high school. But I think from an early age, I sort of wanted to try to do something different from what I've known. So I've always been comfortable with uncertainty and trying to go explore and see what else is out there. So that led me out of medicine and more towards business, even though I didn't really have much experience with that growing up. And then at Duke, despite starting pre-med, I ended up majoring in econ and history. And I ended up in Chicago after college at a place called McMaster Car, which is about as far away from, you know, fashion e-commerce startups as possible. It's a nuts and bolts industrial parts distributor that started in 1901, but I just loved the company and, you know, spent my first 5 years there. Loved the business, loved the access and the sort of visibility that it gave me to how big the economy is. I think that's one of the first realizations I had that, you know, you can just make one single aluminum aircraft screw and be an enormous company and buy a ton of stuff from McMaster Car. So what I didn't love about it was how incremental and already big. Everybody that was there was really intelligent, and I felt like we were working on incremental problems. And I really wanted to be doing something more impactful on a smaller scale where I had more ownership and upside, and not just financially, just in terms of the impact that I could have on a business. So from McMaster, I ended up at a private equity company called Sterling, and they made most of their money on buying and selling Hooked on Phonics, but they had one of these sort of outlier portfolio companies called Dryfire, and we made, of all things, flame-resistant underwear. And that was necessary because soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan were having bad outcomes, getting hit by IEDs. And despite having $10,000 of Kevlar outerwear on to protect them, their base layer polyester garments were melting to their bodies and killing them, which was really, really bad, obviously. So Dryfire was using, you know, performance technology with flame-resistant materials to make a garment that was both moisture-wicking and quick-drying, which is important in the desert, but also protective. So, you know, lucked into that and ended up actually, you know, making apparel, going to Fall River, Massachusetts, of all places, and working with factories and cut and sew shops and really learning how to actually make clothing. And in the process, met a guy who went to college with Brian Spaley, who was the co-founder of Bonobos and at the time was in Chicago at his own private equity firm. And we became social friends, and I just always thought he was kind of the loud guy with ugly pants. But eventually, you know, he told me these stories of how great Bonobos was doing. And then, you know, I was literally making clothing, and they needed a guy to do operations for their clothing company, and just got lucky and really liked Andy and Brian when I met with them in a more interview capacity, and ended up out in New York as the second employee of Bonobos in around May of 2008. And then just held a ton of different leadership and creative and marketing and production positions there from 2008 till the end of 2012. You know, my main claims to fame, or the things I'm most proud of, I would say, are naming a lot of the pants, which are famously Goofy, which was just sort of a dream job for me, is making puns about pants. Couldn't have been a better fit at the time, but, you know, I think my favorite was a Christmas pant that we called the Legnogs.
Oh, it's classic.
But
it's really classic.
Yeah, there were 1,000. It was just so much fun, and tons of like-minded people trying to have fun with the brand and build something kind of on the front lines of e-commerce, not just e-commerce apparel, but the first ever sort of major brand launched online. Also, you know, had a little bit of a role in developing the guide shop strategy. I think it really interesting to look at how the e-commerce business was going, and Andy realized, you know, we were going to need some other channels here to make the business actually succeed. And he hired a guy named Mark Lovis to come in and help expand our sales channels, specifically through direct sales, like trying to go to offices to sort of carry on the tradition of these trunk shows that we did early on. Proved to be kind of weird. Like, we would just go to people's banker offices and look at the internet together, and we would tote in a bag of bonobos to try on. It just wasn't a very good experience. It's like, where's the mirror in a bank to go look at yourself in the mirror? But we did very quickly hear from customers that they would love to come check out the office. And, you know, little by little, we transformed it into a little makeshift store. And then I calculated the sort of revenue per square foot there. And when we realized it was better than the Apple store in that first few weeks, like, we realized we had something. And then Mark and I, you know, became good friends, and we left. Mark left first, and I stuck around Bonobos for a little bit longer, but eventually left to join him at TrueMaker, which sort of carried out the original vision of doing direct sales for a men's clothing brand. The idea there was there is a lot of custom clothing product solution, but very little in the way of like a good brand at the time. So we were trying to create. Internally, we called it J. Crew Cut For You. Like, if you could go to a cool brand like J. Crew, but almost everything was made for you. Yeah, and I started there as first employee and just, again, did a little bit of everything, but focusing on trying to make the e-commerce experience blend and enhance the direct sales experience, which proved to be a monumental challenge. But yeah, made great clothing, and it's still up and running. The San Francisco men's apparel scene is pretty small, and we tend to all know each other, so when I heard about Miles, it was from Mike Mahar, the co-founder and CEO of Tailor Stitch, who I actually share an office with now. And Miles is a spin-out, our two dads, I call them. Co-founding companies are Huck Berry and Tailor Stitch. And they started Miles back in 2014. And it's just done well enough at this point to warrant its own leadership and cap table and direction. And when I heard about the opportunity, I was very excited because it was a chance to go from being the second employee and then the first employee into being the CEO. And I felt like that was just a great scenario for me to make that leap and try my hand as a leader in this industry. So yeah, that's how I got to here. And now trying to take Miles to the next level in this very crowded space.
Wow, that's a thrilling journey. And it sounds almost like you've been through the Ivy League of men's apparel. You know, you really came at it sounds extremely humble of you too, because you mentioned right place at the right time quite a few points there, but it seems like you must have delivered pretty well to be able to kind of capitalize on some of those opportunities. So very cool stuff.
Thank you for saying that. I think, you know, when I think about my journey and everyone's journey to a large extent, you know, you have the opportunity to get lucky, but you also make a lot of your own luck. Mm-hmm. I definitely see both sides of that. I mean, we definitely tried really hard to make these companies work. And despite tall odds in a lot of cases, you know, they worked. And then being able to meet Brian and to meet Andy was lucky. And then it was a good decision to follow them. So it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that in any scenario, I think.
I am reading, it's a book called The Success Equation by a guy who is I'm not sure if he's an institutional investor right now, but no, he's working in the capital markets, Michael J. And I'm going to butcher his last name, but Malbusen. And he has just really teasing out that idea. I'm at the beginning of the book, so I can't recommend it yet, but that notion of, like, you know, what games can we play that are skill and what games can we play that are luck, even in the professional world or in business. So I think you're onto something, but anyway, that's an aside. Now, you have a pretty unique position in the industry, I'd say, in having been around for some of the more disruptive plays that have come up, but also now you started at Miles in September 2018, was it?
That's right.
You are also stepping in when direct consumer, I don't know if I would call it mature, but you know, some of the, it's not new anymore. And so, you know, what are some of the things that really get you excited about stepping into a competitive space in men's apparel?
Well, I think recently spoke about this in a number of different conversations, but we're kind of in this age of the micro brand where it seems like a lot of people can get a product made and put up some ads on Instagram and appear like they're a new online brand. And in a way, that's great. Love having all the options. I love seeing all this creativity being expressed. And in another way, you know, it's a huge challenge for folks like us to sort of rise above the din and to be relevant. One thing I'm excited about is that Miles has been around since 2014. So we were early, at least I think in terms of making a crossover men's athletic apparel garment. It just speaks to the importance of having a message and a product that can stand on its own and stand out while also staying true to the trend that a lot of people don't want super logo emblazoned garments right now. So there's competing trends there where you got to do what you can to stand out, but you also are getting less bang for your buck in a lot of cases by plastering your logo all over everything. I think most consumers, at least in my space, prefer good quality at a fair price over a logo that in itself drives up the price or is the defining feature of the garment.
That's a really fascinating thing because you've got two edges of that sword, right? Where you have to both build up a brand that is valuable and people understand why it's worth paying for, but at the same time, do it so the people who know, or you know, what does brand building look like when it's not emblazoned or it's not being flaunted like American Eagle written across the shirt or something?
Well, I think we're finding out. There are some good examples from brands like Allbirds. They have a really simple story that's based on comfort. It's based on minimalism of design, on versatility. There's a sustainability story there. And there's also a price story. I think $95 for those shoes is pretty attractive. So I think the best brands in the industry have purpose. They tend to have a price story, and the absolute best ones combine both of those into a powerful brand. I think Everlane, obviously, is another one that's cited often just with transparency, but they're also quite affordable, and that does really well online. I think one thing we saw at Bonobos is it's just really hard to sell expensive stuff online with any reliability. It can happen, but part of the reason the guide shops were so impactful was that people want to buy different things in different ways with different experiences. And when we sold a bunch of suits that weren't quite right, we had a 65% return rate and a horrible financial outcome. Once we got the suit fit right and then we sold it in the guide shop model, the suit business really took off. And that's true of a lot of the other categories at Bonobos. But in general, selling really expensive stuff online, I think isn't a real high volume play, at least from where I'm coming from. I think that it's important to be able to convey value and a high quality to price ratio, and then have your brand stand for things other than just its name. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to build that story out at Miles. And it's part of the reason I joined and am excited about the brand. I think that there's a lot of natural tendency at the company to care about things like sustainability or about, you know, mental and physical health. So not only will these things be important to us as individuals and as part of our culture internally, but those will be things that we talk about externally. And I think that modern consumers reward brands that do that in an authentic way. They're more willing to pay a premium in some cases for sustainability versus, say, like just having the Supreme logo. Now, that's a bad example because people pay out the wazoo for the Supreme logo, but you know what I mean?
No, that makes sense. And I'm going to really zero in on one of the words you use there. So, you know, authentic. It's very difficult, you know, and I'm not saying this in a negative way, but authenticity as a corporation can just be difficult. What are some ways that you've seen or been able to really keep the message authentic when you're working with brands?
It sounds complicated if you overthink it. If you mean what you say and it's truly how you feel, I think it comes across in the messaging and in the way you do business. You know, when Andy Dunn said he really wanted to be known for great customer service, it wasn't just a marketing line. We backed it up with just excellent customer service people and sometimes really money-losing customer service policies. But that was what we had to do to sort of earn the trust and to be taken seriously. as an early online brand. And then I think with somebody like Miles, these ideas came both from, you know, yes, this happens to be like something that's going to be good for trends in the market, but it came from these whiteboard sessions when I first got to the business and asked the employees, what do you guys care about? What do you think we should be about? What do you think this is about so far? Now, how do you think customers would characterize us? And these were our honest answers and the things that we said we wanted the company to stand for. And I think to have a good culture where you're asking a lot of people and, you know, asking for long-term commitment and the full effort, you want to create a culture and a brand that people, especially the very earliest people, care a lot about and feel like is an extension of themselves in a way. And so it just so happens that all of these things are common values that we share, and that's what we're going to build the brand on. I think that in a lot of ways, we've just sort of articulated and amplified ideas that were already on the site before I got here and already, you know, in the brand before I got here. I'm just helping the team to identify what those things are that make up the messaging hierarchy and then talk more about it, you know, just talk more about the stuff we like to talk about, and the rest will follow naturally. It's less of a strategy than just what kind of company do we want to be a part of and to share with our customers.
Yeah, no, it's easier and harder than a strategy, right? It's easier in the sense that you don't have to think about it. I guess it just goes along with telling the truth in general. When you tell the truth, you don't have to remember what you said.
Exactly.
But the hard thing is sometimes it excludes things, or you say, wow, I'd love to take this other easier route, but it's against those things we said. We really have to make the tough decision.
Totally. And I think as an individual in life, in any situation, you get to speak your truth. And that's the truth as you know it. There's always going to be haters who don't believe that you really care about mental health or, you know, whatever the example is. And there's so much of that noise now, certainly more than there was when we started at Bonobos, but it was there as well. You know, we had haters, but we really believed in it. And that's really all that matters ultimately. And then customers who appreciate that will gravitate towards your business. And the best thing you can do is just continue to cultivate that experience rather than worry about all the cynicism that can be out there when people don't trust your authenticity, you know?
Yeah. And it's also a great point that there's really a limit to what you can change. And I think sometimes there's a vocal minority that can make it feel like, oh my gosh, no one really resonates with this message. But they're not the people who are buying anyway, right? They're not the people who are really appreciating and enjoying the product anyway. So obviously not trying to build a bubble and ignore people, but at the same time, just focusing in on the voices that really make sense.
Definitely. Yeah, I just don't think anyone gets a lot out of the comments section these days.
Yeah.
I definitely read it, you know, I read it and we'll react to it, you know, no matter what comment section it is. It's not just for Miles, but just in general, I think that being able to filter out that noise and negativity is really important, especially as you're building a brand, you know, because certain people will like it.
Yeah, that's a really great point. So, you know, I think it's also fascinating that you stepped into, like you said, a role that, or a company that's been around since 2014, but it's really an area that you don't hear quite as much about, of coming into an existing team and really hoping to help them grow. So, you know, what are some of the challenges of stepping into an e-commerce brand that already exists? And then maybe what are some of the benefits too of saying like, hey, in my first 90 days, my life was much easier because I already had a team in place, or, you know, whatever those things might be.
Yeah, I would say that it's almost all pros, very few cons. In terms of the cons, I think to a very specific subset of potential investors, as I go out and try to raise money, the fact that I'm not the original founder and that I don't own 95% of the business already and I'm trying to be a billionaire in a tech outcome or something, you know, that can be a red flag in some cases. Like, I'm not fully understood yet on why that is so, because I think if you enjoy what you're doing and you trust that you'll be rewarded for it, it should be enough in a lot of cases. But it's just a certain subset of investors, I think, find the lack of an original founder story to be a little troubling. That's really the main drawback, and that's a very mild one. In terms of the pros, again, I'm lucky because I think the existing team has done such a good job shepherding the business and the brand to the point where it is now. So while I think there are ways we can enhance the brand, there's not a lot of inconsistency. While I think there are stories we can add to this, I think the stories that they have told are really, really good and impactful. And all of that is reflected in the performance of the business where, you know, we haven't taken any money or sought any money at this point, but here we are. So we've obviously been cash flow positive and profitable. We have a lot of customers. We have great repeat purchase metric. There's a real thing here. It's not a proof of concept stage anymore. It's a let's build some infrastructure and grow to the next phase, which is just wonderful because I get to skip a lot of the most scary and difficult parts of starting a brand, which is sort of putting yourself out there and seeing if anybody likes it. It's like being on stage and going and, you know, singing a song and nobody likes it. You know, that's not a great feeling. These guys have done a really good job with it. And what I would say also is that I've been in men's apparel startups for better or worse since 2007. So I know what I'm doing. A lot of things that I've learned on the fly in the past are super useful now and very relevant. And so thinking about what types of businesses I'd like to take over, this one made a lot of sense because I felt very qualified to do it, which helps me focus on all the other things that, you know, maybe considered more soft skills, like developing the team and the culture and thinking about conceptually, where do I want this to be in 5 years versus trying to figure out, like, is anybody ever going to buy my product? I've never had to worry about that. So what I get to do is be patient and think about what's going to appeal to our customers, what's going to feel true to us, and what's going to create the culture that we want to be a part of for a long time.
It's such a great point because I often look at, you know, some of the pre-revenue companies and maybe more in the SaaS businesses than the e-commerce business, but they have some really cool ideas, but that kind of existential risk of people not wanting the thing that we're building or people not wanting the product that we're about to launch is a big deal, right? And requires a little bit more short-term thinking, you know, because you want to consider like what's going to happen to our cash situation in 3 months.
Right.
It's hard to make a 10-year plan if like you're not around in 10 years.
I think that this too, just from a personal standpoint, goes back to my history. I've always been around sort of tangible businesses. And if not, you know, being a doctor is a very tangible, easy to understand idea, right? Like my parents helped people get healthy. And then I went to McMaster Car. We sell nuts and bolts to industrial companies. That's a very tangible, easy to understand idea. I've never been in a business where it's like, this does some sort of technology thing that maybe somebody doesn't want. I've never understood that. So maybe it's a shortcoming on my part. But what I love about apparel, even though it's not, you know, the high-flying tech VC industry necessarily in every case, people do need to get dressed. People need clothing. What Bonobos helped usher in is this notion, especially with men, that there are just a lot more options out there. And guys have varied taste. And they just want better solutions that fit their lives more and make them feel better about themselves and, you know, less afraid to get dressed. I think I can remember being kind of afraid to get dressed in a lot of cases and just not knowing if I looked good or bad. And that may still be the case in some events. But, you know, I think that I, for one, changed the way I thought about clothes and getting dressed when I met Brian and started working at Bonobos and just sort of thinking more critically about the types of purchases I made in this category and others. And e-commerce has just created a universe where there are tons of different options and tons of different tastes to exploit and to satisfy out there. And that's great. I think that's a good thing. The fact that we can have a lot of micro brands that fit a lot of tastes and serve a lot of needs is wonderful. I think with you know, trying to become a bigger brand, it's just a different challenge. And I'm frankly excited about that at Miles because I think we have that chance to have mass appeal, but also a premium feel and also have this conversation with a customer that I think isn't necessarily out there yet in exactly the right way. So,
yeah, that is a cool place to be where, like you said, guys are going to continue getting dressed whether they want to or not. And so pretty safe on the baseline demand, but figuring out the way to get the bigger story out. And so one of the common themes is the notion of ad load, right? It's not a new concept, but the fact that it's not getting any cheaper to acquire customers and it's not getting any easier to get a story out there. You know, are there vehicles or channels that you go, oh, I'm thrilled to put this message out and tell people about Miles through this method? Or, you know, is it something that you go, it's going to work incrementally, we're going to compound steadily and can really, yeah, get folks on board in a gradual way?
We've always talked about blocking and tackling or various other metaphors. Andy used to talk about lead bullets. There's no silver bullets, only lead bullets. And I think to a large extent, it's blocking and tackling, doing the right stuff, doing best practices of what you know is available and doing it well. And then being aware of opportunities that arise. I think that being open to saying yes to new technologies is pretty interesting and important. There's always a time at the beginning of something, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or Pinterest, where there are outsized returns for people who recognize what the opportunity is. And if I knew what all of those were right now, I would not tell them on this show, obviously. But, you know, I think it's just important to be aware of the ecosystem. And certainly the ecosystem now versus 2008 is just populated with incredible people doing incredible stuff. I remember having to like manually segment every email list to try to do any email segmentation, whereas now it's just a couple of drop downs and, you know, things that took me hours are now like a 10-minute thing. So the ecosystem has moved, you know, quickly to fulfill the needs to get these incremental productivity improvements, which I think, you know, in aggregate are really, really impactful. It's not always about finding that silver bullet, but it's about keeping your eyes open for it. The other thing I'd say is with the guide shops at Bonobos and with just our general approach at TrueMaker, we understood the importance of the in-person experience. And I really love, this is going to sound like a detour, but I really love Restoration Hardware as a company. And I feel like their journey, while the rest of the industry has been kind of focused on, you know, what's going to happen with online, et cetera, they've stayed really true to their principles and they've created really wonderful sort of in-person experiences. They've chosen to invest in something that they felt was right. And now I think that that's reinforcing their online business. It's made their community stronger. It's helped their product. They've done all sorts of satellite projects, whether it's like art galleries and just other things that felt kind of superfluous, but were very brand enhancing. They just seem to have taken one of the most comprehensive, holistic approaches to what does this brand mean across channels, across different business lines, across product lines, and build it into something that means a lot to the consumer. So I think with someone like Miles and with other clothing companies, we're not going to be able to just sell on our little Instagram stores. You know, we're going to need to be able to reach the customer wherever they are in meaningful ways, in consistent ways that gets our broader brand idea across regularly. And I think that the people that do that really, really well are going to end up like Restoration Hardware and start to see the benefit of, you know, brand loyalty, of being able to sell at full price, being able to sell across categories and, you know, getting strong NPS scores, for instance. But yeah, it's trite, I guess, to say it at this point, but the multi-channel approach and being able to reach customers in lots of different ways, but with consistent messages that help them understand what it is you're about, I think it's going to be really important.
I think with Restoration Hardware, you hit on something very solid. And I mean, another one of the ideas is that, you know, when you think of how many transactions are done online versus offline, you know, let's just compare the base rates, right? If I said there's a guy, he's 25 years old, he's got to buy a pair of shoes. What are the odds he buys online and what are the odds he buys offline? You know, what would you say those numbers are?
For me, I mean, at 25 years old, probably 50-50.
Yeah. And the interesting thing of base rates is I think that, you know, even when you split up the cohorts, right? So I'm 30. I still have never bought a pair of shoes online. And the base rate is, you know, something like 78% of all retail transactions were offline and, you know, 23% were online. We'll adjust the base rates for age and we'll say like it's 40-60 or maybe it's 50-50, but it sure isn't 80-20 the other way, right?
I just think we're still really early in that curve. The internet isn't that old, you know, and there are a lot of problems to solve with online shopping just in terms of the experience. And many of them can never be solved. Like I don't think that we're going to have teleportation technology that's going to put that shoe in your hands. You want to go and feel it. So, and I don't think that will ever go away. There were heady times in 2007 and 8 when bonobos were, we were echoing the sentiments of folks like Andreessen, who said, you know, e-commerce retail is going to completely eat traditional retail. And what are we going to do with all this real estate, you know? And the opposite, not really the opposite, but just some far more blended reality is what has come to pass. I think for the better, we like to have commerce as a real estate anchor in our neighborhoods. People love to shop in person. And I think seeing them as complementary things has been in fashion for a long time. I just think it's going to be especially important in the age of the micro brand to figure out ways to surface for the customer outside of Instagram and Facebook and Pinterest, and in meaningful ways, not just, you know, a direct mailer here and there. And I think for some brands, when they're in a different phase than Miles, which is really sort of in a growth phase after proof of concept. But I think about, you know, Third Love, one of the things that made them successful, and this is the bra company, I think they just, once they got some marketing wins, they figured out how to become omnipresent. You know, everywhere you turned, you saw Third Love. That helped them get to scale. It wasn't as much about targeting at that point. It was about, we're going to become a household name, you know, come hell or high water. Like, we're just going to be everywhere that our customer could possibly be. And they made the finances work, you know, with great conversion and a great product. And small brands can't do that. And so you got to kind of figure out how to get your own growth early on. But then as you get bigger, I think, you know, becoming more of a constant presence is a way to scale. But you got to crawl, walk, run, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, and like teleport for some of those brands, it's like crawl, rock, walk, run, fly as fast as the speed of sound.
Right.
Growth can happen really quick. And especially, and I think that's the other exciting thing about the omnichannel idea is there, you know, these distribution channels are well developed too. And maybe it changes some of the ways you interact with the customer, but you know, Nike has scale, right?
Totally. The malls aren't dying quietly. They're trying to figure out how to exist in this new reality as well. So they've got a lot of real estate available. They don't necessarily have the ability to rely on a big profitable anchor tenant anymore in some cases. So they're trying out things like, you know, why don't we have these temporary zones where internet brands can come in and exist for a month and then they go away and a different internet brand comes in. So physical retail is starting to figure out how to use its assets in the reality of e-commerce. And I think that's a nice synergy and complement where a brand like Miles could go and exist in a little temporary shop inside of some other larger shop at a mall and get some eyes on us that we wouldn't have otherwise. And the mall gets the benefit of having novelty for its customers and a reason to come back, not just, you know, JCPenney or Sears or whatever.
That's really neat. And I mean, it feels like, you know, real estate, really we're talking about like purchasing attention and saying how much attention do we acquire? And can we make that a little bit more of a variable cost instead of a fixed cost, right? Like the JCPenney said, we're willing to spend X on this amount of attention. But it turns out there's not that much buying intent coming by now. It's not zero either. It's definitely a non-zero number.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't know if JCPenney is necessarily the right example, but just folks who operate a mall in downtown Seattle, for instance, and they consistently have great traffic, I think, for them to try to connect with a consumer in a way that brings in the internet rather than looks at it as an adversary, you know, they team up. It's a little bit more like with the recording industry. I wish they had embraced the internet earlier on rather than looking at it entirely as an adversary. And I, you know, there's some creative ways where physical and, you know, e-commerce retail are working better together, even when they're sort of maybe at odds in certain ways. And then, yeah, I mean, in terms of all of the channels that we may play in, I don't necessarily view them as distribution as much as marketing. And we always got real great digital lift around the physical locations where we launched a new store for Bonobos. And I've heard similar stories from other retailers. You know, it doesn't have to be a boring store. It could be a fun store. It could be something experiential. It could be something that enhances the brand more than it moves units. And you take a loss on it, but at least people understand what you stand, you know, what you're about a little bit more. There's a lot of different ways that, you know, we may look at it at Miles, but it's not 100% like I got to move X number of units to make this profitable. Could be, you know, I come close to breaking even, but a lot of people came in and read our brand story and, you know, left with a discount code or something to buy their first pair of Miles shorts online later.
No, that's a great point. You know, and you bring up something interesting when you mentioned the music industry, right? And having this, maybe we could say like ossified or this notion, it's really hard to shift and see the opportunity or see the potential synergies in something that's like a big threat to your existence. And, you know, along those lines, I know organizations anybody can have that happen. I think of myself, or I'm 30 now, but in 20 years, what am I going to view as like the new upstart fad that I don't really want to learn about because it's just a lot of work? How do you, as the leader at Miles, one of the leaders of Miles, how do you really try to build an organization that doesn't say no by default, right? That doesn't just say, oh, well, whatever, you know, this new lead bullet is, like, we don't need that one because we've got these old lead bullets and everybody knows their best practices. Yeah. How do you play with that tension or play within that tension at an organization that, you know, has other people there that we all want to get steady? We want to hit homeostasis.
I have the decision-making parameters set for me in a way. I don't have infinite money and time.
Yeah.
So it's not a matter of saying no by default. It's a matter of sort of ruthless prioritization. Mm-hmm. And identifying something as signal or noise right away as best you can, and then putting all of your options on a list. But, you know, I can't do all of them. I mean, this is a more interesting question for me if I have sort of like, okay, now you have tons of money. You guys have, you've grown to X million dollars already. What are you going to do to get to the next level? That gets a little bit more interesting. And that's frankly a skill I'll have to learn. Mostly I've been at small companies and feel comfortable deciding what the next most important thing is. And, you know, my belief is that it'll probably be a very similar thought process. Like, here we are at 100 million in revenue. What's the next most important thing? And just keep thinking that way. It just comes down to people and what kind of person you have. I think the folks that come to a startup are not looking to just punch the clock and go home and do sort of a rote set of tasks without thinking about them. They're there because they see opportunity. They see creativity. They're excited about the aspect of the job that is slightly uncertain and risky, but what makes it more meaningful and potentially rewarding for them. And certainly how I look at it, you know, I'm comfortable with uncertainty at this point. I think you got to be. And that's what makes a really, really great outcome possible in everyone's minds. And it's a matter of, you know, making that outcome seem very exciting and attainable. And then also just doing the blocking and tackling again to get it done. I just don't think there's any single thing where, you know, if we had said yes to it, it would have worked. I think that there, and this is kind of an old Amazon Jeff Bezos thing. There are two types of decisions, some that you should do quickly because they're not really that, you know, they're not going to change your life or threaten your business. And then there are some that are really, really important where if you get them wrong, like they could change everything. So it's like in personal life, that's getting married, I think, something like that. In business, it's like, okay, am I going to spend millions of dollars on inventory right now? I got to think really hard about that decision. You know, every other decision, like, should we make yellow or orange? You know, you want to have a framework for it, but you make the best decision you can and move quickly past it and hope to, you know, aggregate a lot of good small decisions over time while avoiding, you know, making big mistakes that can put you at risk. You know, the rest of it, I think, is like about small micro decisions that add up to sort of positive momentum. And that's how I feel we are at Miles. I think that's what these guys have done over the last 4 years, and I get to come in and try to add some momentum to that.
Well, when you cross the 100 million mark, we'll have to have you back.
Yeah, hopefully next year.
Yeah, exactly. We'll set a calendar invite right now. I'll send it out.
Right.
Wow. Well, I think that's a neat view. And it really feels like in, you know, e-commerce years, you've worked in the industry for 40 years. Like, I think back to some of these things, like, man, he was around at the beginning of Bonobos. Like, this is amazing. So, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do is hear a little bit about almost like building up a little library, like the Lean Commerce Library. So any books throughout your career, or even just personal life, that you've read more than three times? My litmus test is, you know, the first time I might read it, it could be a great idea. But if I read it more than three times, it's become kind of a reference, or I go back to it.
Yeah, well, there aren't any business books that I've read more than three times, but there are two that I can think of offhand. One is D-Man by Hermann Hesse. It's really a story of self-actualization and being honest with oneself. A little bit of a cheesy answer, but I just love that book. There's a quote in it, and I won't get it exactly right, but it's one of the main characters just says, like, I wanted nothing more than to live in accordance with my true self. And why was that so very difficult? And I think about that a lot, you know, because I want to live in accordance with my true self. I want to, you know, seek out goals that are going to mean something to me, not what are external necessarily, or what is going to prove to somebody else that I'm worthy. So it's less about seeking validation and more just doing what is right for me and what is going to make my life meaningful. So I really love that one. And then Separate Piece is just a great story about friendship and the nuance of friendship and how to deal with admiring somebody, dealing with all the different flavors of jealousy. And, you know, again, it's a lot about, for me, self-actualization and always, you know, trying to grow up into a better adult. Now, I admit I haven't read that one for a long, long time, but I did read it a lot of times as a kid. Demian, I come back to every once in a while. It's more of a philosophical guide for me, just on trying to understand what is my true self and how to work towards it.
Man, so we've got two follow-ups, the 100 million mark, and then in a year to see what your true self is right now.
Yeah, it changes every year.
No, these are very helpful. I think we were talking about Man's Search for Meaning on an earlier episode, and it's a similar thing, right? Where there's a fundamental desire to have a life that matters. And I think that with a lot of the most driven founders or the most, you know, driven entrepreneurs or the managers that are going to have a big impact, it's because they're connected to something that's larger, right? Like I know that I feel like I've got a mission and really want to live that mission out in a powerful way and go, wow, okay, this is an exciting thing to be able to do.
Totally. Yeah. And I think back to who my best managers were and who I enjoyed working for and with, and it tends to be people who always saw sort of the forest through the trees. They just really saw what, you know, whatever work project we were on at the time, what it means in a grander scheme and with a lot of humanity. It's, of course, a lot of fun and we're all here to win, but being alive and part of a fun group of people is always the most important thing in my mind.
Being alive is very high up there for sure.
Yeah, right. That's part of the brand. Like we just want to be alive as long as possible. We're not trying to win a football game anymore. We're just trying to be as happy and healthy as we can for as long as possible.
Well, Adam, thanks so much for coming on. This has been a terrific episode, and I think you had some solid insights. If people want to find out more about Miles, what's the best place to go?
Go to milesapparel.com, and that's MYLESAPPARELL.com.
Sounds great. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Adam.
All right. Thanks, Lance.
Thanks for listening. If you love the show, leave a review on iTunes. See you next time.